to tonight's forum event. My name is Beth Hannon. I'm the Associate Director of the forum. We've been putting on events like this for the last 20 years or so. Philosophy-themed lectures, panel discussions, debates. Almost all of them are free and they're all open to the public. And the reason we're able to do that is because we have some very generous donors and the support of the LSE, for which we are very grateful. During term time, we do events like this about once a week. If that's not quite enough to satisfy your philosophical desires, we also have a blog, which you're very welcome to visit. We have a hashtag for tonight, if you feel like live tweeting along. But do turn off the volume on your phone. Tweet away, turn off the volume. And tonight's event is being recorded for a podcast, so if you ask a question, do wait for the roving mic to find you so your voice can be picked up on the podcast. Okay, that's enough for me. I'll hand you over to Jonathan, who will introduce my speaker.
Okay, thanks, Beth. I'm Jonathan Birch. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy, Logic and Scientific Method here at the LSE. And it's great to be introducing my colleague, Suzanne Burry, also an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at the LSE, and an expert on the ethics of war. I mean, just to give you a sense of the format of the event, in a moment Suzanne will talk for about 50 minutes or so, and then that should give us around 30 minutes or so for questions afterwards. So fairly straightforward, traditional format. And Suzanne today is going to be talking to us about the moral complexities of World War II bombings. Hand over to Susan.
Thank you, Jonathan, and thank you all for joining us tonight. So in my talk today, I will first lay out the historical details of a morally problematic decision situation that the British authorities found themselves in towards the end of World War II. I will then move on to a discussion of the moral complexities that underlay the British decision situation. So let's start with the historical details. In June of 1944, the German Wehrmacht started her terror bombing London. The V weapons that the Germans fired at London, where the V in V weapons stood for Vergeltung, which means retaliation, were guided missiles that German engineers had started to develop in the late 1930s. They looked something like this. So this is an illustration I found on the internet. When the terror bombing of London started in June of 1944, the guided missiles were at a stage of development where they were performing reasonably well in test runs, but they still had some major flaws. The most important flaw was that their guidance system was not yet very accurate, so that the German engineers really needed to know where their bombs were falling in order to make the necessary adjustments to fine-tune their weaponry. Now, during the war, the British press was heavily censored, and the Germans were, of course, well aware of this. So they knew that they could not rely on newspaper reports to find out where their bombs had fallen. They also could not do reconnaissance flights over London because German surveillance aircraft would have made a very easy target for the Royal Air Force. For these two reasons, the Germans turned to their spies that they had stationed in London and asked the spies to report back as quickly and as accurately as possible the bomb incidents that they knew about or that they could get information about. Now, as it happened, many of the London-based German spies had, by June of 1944, been turned into British double agents. So they were no longer working for Germany, but they were working for the British. And these double agents now asked their British contacts what they should report back to the Germans. And here are a couple of considerations that were relevant for the British authorities. First, the British authorities thought it extremely likely that the Germans had made Charing Cross, the busy railway station in central London, the target mean point of impact of the bombs. So here we have Charing Cross, the busy railway station in central London, and the British just suspected that Charing Cross was the target mean point of impact of the German bombs because in that way the Germans were maximizing the expected negative impact on critical infrastructure, on civilian lives, and on British morale. But the British soon realized that the V weapons were on average falling short of their presumed targets. So while individual bombs fell scattered all over the Greater London area and actually all around Southeast England at large, the brunt of the attack was definitely in Dulwich, which is roughly 4 miles southeast of Charing Cross. So here, I mean, this is not the actual historical situation, it's just an illustration of what the situation roughly looked like a few days after the bombing had started. So So the black dots are just individual bomb incidents, and we can see that the bombs are falling most heavily here around Dulwich, roughly 4 miles southeast of Charing Cross, which the British suspected was the target mean point of impact of the German bombs. So a few days after the bombing had started, it just looked like the Germans were undershooting their presumed target. Now, individual bombs had a very limited blast radius, and they tended not to be very deadly, but many of them were fired at London each day, like up to 40, 90 each day. And when the bombing stopped on 28 March 1945, just under 4,000 B weapons had reached the Greater London area, and they had killed about 9,000 civilians and had injured about 25,000. Many bombs had resulted in no casualties, but some bombs were actually very deadly indeed. And the deadliest bomb was one that fell on Saturday, the 25th of November in 1944, in New Cross, South East London. It hit a department store that was full of weekend shoppers, and it killed 168 people and left 122 seriously injured. So this is just that you have some idea about what these V weapons were like. Now, to go back to the British decision situation, in June of 1944, only a couple of days or weeks after the bombings had started, the British authorities really needed to decide what information the double agents should pass on to the German controllers. In this situation, Sir Samuel Findlater Stewart, who was the chairman of the Home Defence Executive, a committee that had been set up to defend Britain against enemy forces, he came up with a deception policy that he sent to the Armed Forces Chiefs of Staff for approval. So he had a very good idea, and his proposal was to have the double agents selectively report actual incidents so as to, and I quote him, create the impression that the bombs are appearing to overshoot the target in the hope that the range and deflection may be moved further to the east and south than it is at present. So in other words, Stewart's idea was to redirect the bombs even further away from central London by feeding the Germans true but selectively and strategically selective information. So Stewart's idea was that the double agents should report back roughly these bomb incidents. And what would then happen is the Germans would think they were currently overshooting their target, which the British presumed to be Charing Cross. So what the Germans would do is to adjust their aim in this way, and what would actually happen is that the actual mean point of impact of the bombs would move further to the southeast and towards even less built-up areas. So Stewart's proposal was very ingenious because, for one thing, it proposed to be prudent. It protected the excellent reputation that the British double agents had carefully built over the last few years with their German controllers. It protected the reputation by allowing the double agents to report back in a very prompt way, seemingly useful information that was in principle also verifiable. And for the British authorities, safeguarding the double agents' reputation with their German controllers was of great importance because they wanted these double agents to be available for further deception projects in case that the war would drag on. I mean, at this point, no one knew for how long the war would drag on. So it was very important to keep the double agents in play. And Findlater Stewart's proposal also promised to be highly effective in the sense that it promised to result in a net saving of many civilian lives, to also curb the number of bomb-related injuries, obviously, and to reduce the risk of damage to critical infrastructure. According to some official estimates, moving the mean point of impact from its current position in Dulwich, 6 miles further to the southeast, would on average decrease monthly bomb-related fatalities by 1,600. Whereas if for some reasons the Germans would have managed to move the actual MPI, the mean point of impact of the bombs, to Charing Cross, then this would have increased the average monthly bomb-related fatalities by about 500. So moving the mean point of impact further to the southeast promised to save many lives. It promised to be a very effective strategy. And if, as seemed likely, the Germans had no idea but to rely almost exclusively on the reports of their spies to establish where their V weapons were falling, the British, via the double agents, were thus presented with a genuinely valuable opportunity to limit the expected negative impact of the enemy's bombs. Now, Findlater Stewart pressed the Armed Forces Chief of Staff to come to a quick decision in the matter. The double agents have been instructed by their German contacts to make the reporting of bomb incidents their top priority, so that they could not credibly remain silent for very long. And the Chiefs of Staff found that plausible, and they therefore approved Stewart's proposal, and they instructed the deception authorities to go ahead with Stewart's proposal for the time being. But because civilian lives were involved, the Chiefs of Staff also felt that they were not authorized to decide the matter finally. For that reason, they forwarded Stewart's proposal to the War Cabinet Ministers and asked the ministers for the backing of the redirection strategy. Now, on 28 July 1944, so now the bombings have been going on for roughly 6 weeks, the War Cabinet, and Winston Churchill was absent that day, the War Cabinet discussed Stewart's proposal and argued, I quote, that it would be a serious matter to assume any direct degree of responsibility for action which would affect the areas against which flying bombs were aimed. So to the ministers, and I quote again, it was not for the government to authorize action which would result in certain areas in South London getting a heavier discharge of flying bombs and sustaining heavier casualties than they do at the present times. The ministers felt, I quote, that if it came out that the government had authorized such action, their position would be indefensible. So this can be found here. Now, this document was addressed to Winston Churchill. I mean, like I said, he was absent at the War Cabinet meeting that day. And here we get a summary of what the War Cabinet ministers discussed that day and how they came to the conclusion that redirection should be rejected. All the direct quotes in my talk are from original documents. You can view them at the British National Archives in Kew in Richmond, and I went there for like a week to do some archival research. So this is one of these documents that I viewed in Richmond at the National Archives. Now, the War Cabinet's ministers concluded that Findlater Stewart's proposal could not be accepted for these reasons. And instead, I quote, they invited the deception authorities to arrange that the information conveyed to the enemy was such as would create confusion in the enemy's mind and present him with an inaccurate picture. So, in short, or in sum, Findlater Stewart's proposal was deemed unacceptable, even though neither its prudence nor its effectiveness were called into question. And this very much exasperated Findlater Stewart, because he was very proud of his idea, and after all, the effectiveness and the prudence of the proposal were not even questioned. So in a second report, Findlater Stewart argued that confusing the enemy, as the ministers wanted to do, was actually not a viable option at all. It was just something that could not actually be implemented if you thought about it. And Stewart's argument was that the British authorities were forced to give some information to the enemy. This was necessary to maintain what he called our deception machine in being. He then asserted that information could not be given randomly, because the enemy would just draw an inference from whatever bomb incidents were reported back to him, and that the British therefore had to be very careful not to give information that would be to their detriment. And Stewart emphasized that a shift of the enemy's aim to the north or to the northwest would have very serious consequences indeed. So what Stewart did was he proposed a second deception strategy, according to which, I quote, no attempt is to be made to shift the weight of the attack in any direction, and material to be passed over should be selected so as to deny useful information to the enemy and to prevent him from moving the mean point of impact of his attack, particularly to the north. Now, on 15th of August 1944, the bombings have been going on for 2 months now, the War Cabinet, this time at Winston Churchill present, they discussed Findlater Stewart's second proposal. And it seems that they were convinced by Stewart's argument that confusion simply was not a viable option. They let Stewart know that they had reconsidered their original instructions and that they were willing to retract their original instructions, and that the deception authorities' new goal should be, and I can quote here again, so we are here, that Stewart's object should now be to ensure that there is no deterioration in the position of the mean point of impact, and that the enemy does not shift the pattern of his bombs towards the northwest. With this in view, you should continue to convey to the enemy information which will confirm his belief that he has no need to lengthen his range. You are also at liberty within limits to take such steps as you may judge safe to intensify this belief. Now, it's not entirely clear what the deception authorities made of these revised orders. They may have read them as a go-ahead for Stuart's second proposal, so that they just tried to keep the MPI, the mean point of impact, roughly at its current position in Dulwich or wherever it was at this point. Or they may have interpreted these revised instructions as not actually contradicting Stuart's initial proposal, so that they kept attempting to shift the mean point of impact further towards the southeast. What we know for certain is that they managed to induce the enemy to believe that he was on average on target, when in fact he was not. I found German intelligence appreciation of the fall of the V weapons, and this shows quite clearly that the Germans were under the impression that they were hitting central London with some precision, when the actual mean point of impact of all the bombs ended up in Beckenham, which is 8 miles southeast of Charing Cross. And the fact that the eventual mean point of impact lay several miles southeast of Dulwich, where the V weapons were falling most heavily in the beginning, lends support to the hypothesis, that the deception authorities went ahead with Findlater Stuart's initial redirection strategy. Now, together with military authorities, the deception authorities were at any rate extremely careful to avoid renewed involvement of the War Cabinet's ministers in deception issues. As General Ismay wrote to General Hollis on 26 January 1944, the chiefs of staff had got their fingers badly burned by bringing ministers into the deception business, and he, for one, certainly did not want to risk doing so again. So this is the historical situation, basically, as it presented itself. But before we move on to philosophical analysis, I think we need to clarify whether Findlater Stuart was right to claim that confusion was not actually a viable strategy. Because if it was not an implementable strategy anyway, then maybe we don't need to take it seriously as possibly the right thing to do. Now, it seems to me that Stuart was actually way too quick in his judgment that confusion would not have been a viable strategy. Stuart argued that the Germans would calculate a mean point of impact from whatever bomb incidents that were reported back to them, so that randomly selecting bomb incidents would not confuse the Germans. It would merely amount to the throwing away of a strategically very valuable option of influencing the enemy. But I hope you realize that the double agents had other options than just reporting back individual bomb incidents. I mean, that's not all you can do. So double agents could have issued reports that would have cancelled each other. One double agent could have reported a rumour of an impact at some given time and place, and then a second agent could have reported the same rumour, and then he could have reported that he took the time to go and check it out, but then he found no bomb damage. Or the agents could have reported bomb damage in highly specific locations, but combined this with only very rough estimates of the times at which the respective bombs had fallen. This would have made the reports largely useless for the Germans, because the engineers needed to know where individual bombs had fallen. And because many were shot at London each day, once you don't know at what time an individual bomb has fallen, this is somewhat useless information. The double agents could actually quite credibly have claimed that it made them look very suspicious if they walked around bomb sites and asked about the specific time at which a bomb had exploded. When the terror bombing of London started, a double agent named Garbo did in fact use this strategy to play for time while he was waiting for instructions from his British contacts. Garbo then even staged his own arrest, so he claimed he had been arrested because he had asked too many questions at a bomb site. And his German contact actually bought the story, and the German contact told him, "You should just lay low for a while, don't go to any more bomb sites, don't ask any more questions." And the number of agents could, moreover, just have announced that they were not actually willing to stay in London and risk their lives, that they would just be retreating to the countryside for as long as the attacks went on. Some could even have turned the bombings into a personal issue. They could have scolded their German contacts for not giving them an advance warning of the impending attacks, And again, this is a strategy that some actual double agents used to play for time while they were waiting for instructions from the British contacts. For the remainder of this talk, I will just suppose that confusing the enemy would have been a viable strategy. It's something that the British could have implemented if they had wanted to, providing that by confusing the enemy, which is mean providing the enemy with largely useless information from which he should be unable to calculate a mean point of impact. But while confusion would have been feasible compared to Stuart's redirection or compared to the option of keeping the MPI where it currently was, confusing the enemy would clearly have come with additional costs. So for one thing, the British double agents would clearly have lost their excellent reputation with the German contacts. I mean, you cannot keep providing useless information while at the same time appearing reliable and useful. And compared to Stuart's proposal, the redirection strategy had the further problem that if the British had chosen to implement it, they would not have been able to predict where the mean point of impact of the German bombs would subsequently have moved to, or for that matter, whether it would have moved at all. Now, why is that? It seems to me this would have been the case because the British had to reckon that not all German spies had been turned into British double agents. The British just had to assume that once the quality of their double agents' reports started to drop significantly, the Germans would begin to rely more heavily on the reports of the non-turned spies. I mean, the report of the non-turned spies were probably quite fragmentary and not very precise, because the non-turned agents did not have access to the qualified information that the double agents had access to. So once the double agents started to pass on largely useless information, the Germans were likely to begin to rely more heavily on the reports of non-turned spies, and the British authorities had no way of knowing what sort of information the non-turned spies were passing on to the enemy, so that they had no way of predicting where the mean point of impact of the German bombs would move to if they adopted the confusion strategy. So this concludes my discussion of the historical decision situation that the British authorities found themselves in. Now, to summarise, Findlater Stuart had come up with an ingenious redirection strategy that the War Cabinet's ministers were, however, not comfortable with. The ministers would have preferred to confuse the enemy, but Findlater Stuart managed to convince them that confusing the enemy was not actually a viable strategy, so that the ministers eventually endorsed something like a cautious redirection strategy. Now to philosophical analysis. In my philosophical analysis of the historical case, I mean, you could ask many questions about this historical case, but as a person interested in the ethics of war, I want to focus on the following very specific question. I want to ask whether the War Cabinet's ministers were rightly worried about implementing the redirection strategy. So was there any moral consideration that, at least with some force, maybe not very forcefully, but maybe with some force, spoke against the redirection strategy and in favor of the confusion strategy? So is there anything that made confusion attractive compared to redirection? At least at first sight, it's difficult to see what could possibly be morally problematic with redirection. I mean, after all, it promised to be very prudent, to keep the double agents in play, and it promised to be highly effective, or to result in a net saving of many civilian lives and to prevent many injuries. Now, importantly, just to stress this again, I'm not actually trying to find out what the ministers were, in fact, worried about when they rejected Stuart's proposal to redirect the German bombs. I'm trying to find out whether there is something that they should have been worried about. Now, of course, if the ministers were smart and conscientious individuals, as I believe we may assume, then what the ministers were in fact worried about may coincide with what they should have been worried about. That's why I spent quite some time on the historical case and tried to find out what the ministers were in fact worried about. I mean, it might give you some hints about what they should have been worried about. Now, according to the moral philosopher Jonathan Glover, he's one of the few moral philosophers who was aware of the case and discussed it already in the 1970s. However, he gravely misrepresented the historical details. So Glover suggests that we can turn to the so-called doctrine of doing and allowing to understand why the ministers felt hesitant about redirection. So the doctrine of doing and allowing, or DDA, is basically very simple. It may sound complicated because we call it a doctrine, but it just says that actively inflicting harm is worse than merely allowing it to occur. Now, Glover himself is actually someone who does not think that the DDA is correct, so he does not think that actively inflicting harm is worse than merely allowing it to occur. But many moral philosophers endorse the doctrine, and it is more or less in line with common sense as well. I mean, to give an example, most of us would seem to believe that it is worse to kill someone in order not to, in order to spare yourself some inconvenience, than it is not to save someone from being killed or from dying, because it would inconvenience you to do so. So let us, at least for the time being, assume that the distinction between doing harm and merely allowing harm to occur is at least sometimes morally relevant. If so, does the doctrine of doing and allowing help us distinguish between confusion and redirection? From the perspective of the British authorities, would confusing the enemy in some way have been more like allowing harm to occur, whereas redirecting the bombs would have been more like actively inflicting harm on one's own civilians? Now, Glover himself does not address the question because he, like I said, misrepresents the details of the historical case. But this need not concern us here because we can just ask the question and answer it for ourselves. Now, at first glance, it is very difficult to see how redirection could have involved a more direct or a more active way of harming compared to confusion. Whichever strategy the British authorities would have adopted, they would have had to instruct their double agents with very similarly detailed and careful instructions about what to report back to the German contacts. So it would seem that confusion and redirection would have involved structurally very similar interventions from the British government. So it seems strange to say that one type of instructing the double agents would have been more active and one would have been more passive. Now, in my discussion of the feasibility of implementing the confusion strategy, I have suggested that if the British had settled on confusion, they would have been unable to predict where the MPI of the German bombs would subsequently have moved to. Now, one might try to argue that this fact somehow renders confusion more passive than redirection. But if not being able to predict who your victims will be makes a harmful act more passive, then first of all, there's only a difference in degree between confusion and redirection. Because after all, no matter which strategy the British would have adopted, they had no way of knowing precisely which individuals would die as a result of it. With the redirection strategy, the decision makers merely had a clear idea of the risk distribution that that would ensue if they adopted this strategy. But much more importantly, it seems to me that it is incorrect to say that harming someone is more like allowing harm to occur to the extent that you do not know who your victim is. I mean, just imagine for a second that you have a choice, you're presented with a horrible choice where you can either stab someone that is presented to you face to face, or you can stab someone that is presented to you behind a curtain. I mean, not only do both options strike me as similarly horrific, and I hope you as well, but it also does not seem that stabbing someone who's presented to you behind a curtain to some extent is very much akin to merely letting that person be stabbed. I mean, it just seems to be a similarly active act anyway. But still, I actually believe there's something to the DDA. So we can use the doctrine of doing and allowing to make a difference or to find a difference between confusion and redirection. And to see what this difference is, suppose for a second that the ministers of the war cabinet, they really felt the DDA is true. So the distinction between doing harm and merely allowing it to occur is crucial, they thought. And suppose they thought that they have to avoid at all costs getting involved in the harming of their civilians. If so, what should they have done? So it seems to me that they should have simply discontinued all communication to the Germans via the turned spies. They should simply have told their double agents to stop communicating. Don't give any more information to the German contacts. And I will refer to this course of action as the no involvement. I'm stepping back. Not being involved at all. Now, if they had settled on no involvement, it seems likely that the Germans would have relied on the reports of their non-Turn spies to find out where the bombs were falling. The Germans would have used the, like I said, probably quite fragmentary and not especially useful reports of the non-Turn spies to calculate an MPI and adjust their aim accordingly. So the point is that from the perspective of the British authorities, implementing the confusion strategy was expected to have pretty much the same effects as doing nothing at all, or as not getting involved in the bombings at all. But the only difference between confusion and no involvement from the perspective of the British was that with the confusion strategy, there was some hope of keeping the double agents in play for further deception projects. The confusion strategy was dissimilar to merely allowing harm to occur in the sense that the same people could be expected to die that would have died had the British government decided not to get involved at all. And in this sense, confusion is actually more similar to merely allowing harm to occur than its redirection. But even if we can identify this difference, we have in the next step to ask, is this difference morally relevant? Does it seem important? And it seems to me very clear that this consideration was not actually important in the case at hand. The British authority, it seems to me, had no valid moral reason to try and ensure that only those civilians would be harmed who would have been harmed anyway had the British decided not to intervene at all. So to see what I mean, just suppose that after the war, the British authorities made it public that deception had been going on and that there was this possibility to redirect the bombs. And then suppose the British said, actually, we adopted the confusion strategy. And suppose they explained to their citizens that they had adopted the confusion strategy, because in that way, it was as if they had not intervened at all. Sorry. Then surely there would be, or there should be, an outcry among the British public. I mean, when a country is under attack, it's not the government's duty to somehow mimic non-intervention. It's not the government's duty to let the harm or the bombs, in our case, fall where they may. I mean, instead, it's the government's duty to protect the lives of its citizens as well as it can. So the British authorities were not under a duty to somehow mimic non-intervention or to just allow harm to occur. They were under a duty to protect their citizens against the German attack. So I conclude that the doctrine of doing and allowing would to some extent have spoken in favor of confusion over redirection. It helps us identify a feature that does make confusion more like allowing harm to occur, but that given the circumstances of the case, this did not provide the British government with a morally relevant reason in favor of confusion over redirection. Okay, I will now argue, in this last chapter, so to speak, that we can find a morally relevant reason in favor of confusion over redirection, and that we can find this reason once we think more carefully about a government's duty to protect the lives of its citizens. Note that when the terror bombing of London started, it was just clear to the British authorities that no matter what they did, some of their civilians would die. So there was a situation where no matter what the British government decided to do, some of its people, some of its civilians, were bound to die. Now the question is, if a government finds itself in this situation, no matter what it does, some of its civilians will be killed, what should the government do? And one answer, maybe the most immediate answer that comes to mind, is just that it should try to minimize losses. I mean, this answer has considerable intuitive appeal. At least prima facie, it seems quite plausible to say that a state should protect its citizens as effectively as it can, so that it should just try to minimize losses. But there is a second answer that I think, on closer inspection, is actually more plausible. And according to the second answer, a government should strike a balance between protecting its citizens as effectively as it can and showing a balanced concern for the safety of all when these two considerations come into conflict. The basic idea behind the second and slightly more complex answer is that a state owes its duty of protection equally to all of its citizens. Only if the protective measures that it adopts express a sufficiently balanced concern for the safety of all, do the measures that it adopts properly reflect the idea that in a legitimate state, all citizens enjoy an equal standing? Now, had the British authorities chosen to redirect the German bombs, what would they have done? Well, they would have knowingly increased the risk of bomb-related harm to the people living in South London, thereby decreasing the risk of bomb-related harm to those living in North London. So they would have, in a way, taken sides. And this might lead one to believe that redirection did not express an equal concern for the safety of everyone, because implementing it would in some sense have favoured one part of the population over other parts. And the same cannot be said of the confusion strategy, because if the British had adopted the confusion strategy, then I have argued they could not have predicted where the MPI of the German bombs would subsequently have moved to. So you cannot say that adopting the confusion strategy would have expressed some sort of favouring or would have expressed an unequal concern for different parts of the population. But this first idea has many problems. I mean, there's at least one view of equality that will actually tell you that implementing the redirection strategy would not have shown unequal concern. And according to this view, and we may call it utilitarian, minimizing losses just always coincides with showing an equal concern for each citizen. So if you find an advocate of this view, he or she might defend the view as follows. They might say, look, at first sight, the redirection strategy may indeed seem to express unequal concern. Yes, yes, I can see that, because implementing it protects those living in North London at the expense, seemingly, of those living in South London. But first appearances are really deceptive in this case. So public decision makers show an equal concern for the safety of all if and when they assign the same positive value to each civilian life in their calculation about the right thing to do. So by proceeding in this way, by assigning the same positive value to each civilian life in their calculation about the right thing to do, they accept, they assume that no one's life counts for more than anyone else's. And this is what makes their stance egalitarian, in a sense. And from a suitable perspective, moreover, for example, if all citizens were deprived of knowledge of where they lived, a general policy to minimize losses would moreover be in everyone's expected best interest. And then the person could say, this actually lends even further support to the idea that minimizing losses actually just coincides with showing proper and equal concern for the safety of everyone. So the two are just the same thing, according to this view. Now, I believe, and I've tried to convince philosophers of this for a while now, I believe that this argument, it does clarify that there is one way, and an important way, in which minimizing losses does show an equal concern. But the idea that minimizing losses is the same thing as showing an equal concern is false. I think there are instances where it is extremely clear that minimizing losses is not the same or does not suffice to make it the case that the government is showing an equal and a balanced concern for the safety of everyone. So here's an example that I hope will be quite convincing. Suppose that an evil organization threatens terror attacks in the UK. Unless the UK government hands over 20 of its citizens for the evil organization to execute. So the evil organization gives the UK choices. We want these 20 citizens, or we will start terror attacks in the UK. Now, suppose that the evil organization claims that it will not stop its attacks before at least 40 UK citizens have died. So that the UK, if it wants to minimize losses to civilian lives, then it has to hand over the 20 of its citizens that the evil organization wants to execute. Now, probably the UK has many reasons why it should not deliver the 20. I mean, there's the fact that probably it does not pay to negotiate the terrorists, etc. But what I want to say, and what's crucial for our purposes here, is simply the following. If the UK decides to follow the orders of the terrorists, and if the UK delivers the 20 people, the 20 citizens, to the terrorists, then I want to say it would be unacceptably counterintuitive to say that it did this because it protected all of its citizens equally. or that what it did just expressed an equal concern for everyone. It would be much more appropriate to say that it sacrificed the 20 in order to protect everyone else. Now, a few minutes ago, I've said that if the British authorities had implemented the redirection strategy, they would have knowingly increased the risk of death to those living in South London, thereby decreasing the risk of death to those living in North London. And I have suggested it could be this feature that gives the redirection strategy the air of a partial or of a protective measure that does not show an equal concern for everyone. Similarly, in the example that I have just given, if the UK government decided to hand over the 20 of its citizens, it would increase their risk of death while decreasing the risk of death and injury to everyone else. This suggests that a protective measure does not express an equal concern in at least one sense when it increases the risk of death to some while decreasing the risks to others. But this is not actually correct. So this is not the right way of framing the problem. Consider the following protective measures that the British authorities actually implemented in response to the German terror bombing in 1944. So one thing they did is they sent out fighter aircraft, like Royal Air Force planes, that shot down V weapons, not only over the English Channel, but also over southeast England. The British also put up barrage balloons, something like zeppelins, big balloons, in southeast England in order to block, to damage the V weapons that were coming mostly from France. They were actually shot from France. And a third measure that the British also implemented is they shot down V weapons from the ground. So they had these anti-aircraft guns stationed again in rural southeast England, and they were trying to shoot down V weapons from the ground. All of these measures, you will notice, were implemented in or over sparsely inhabited parts of southeast England. So what they did, these measures, is that they increased the risk of bomb-related harm for the people who lived in rural southeast England, and moreover, they all reduced the overall deadliness of the bombs in the Greater London area. So all of these measures increased the risk of death and injury to some, while knowingly decreasing the risk to others. The measures, nevertheless, do not strike me as expressing unequal concern, and I hope you too will find trying to shoot down the V weapons before they reach Greater London or putting up barrage balloons does not somehow express unequal concern for different parts of the population. Now, I offer the following explanation why this is so. Both before and after the introduction of these measures, the brunt of the attacks was still borne by the people who lived in the Greater London area. So each civilian who lived in the Greater London area was at a much higher risk of death and injury than those who lived somewhere else. Putting up barrage balloons or sending out fighter aircraft, trying to shoot down V weapons from the ground, they all mitigated the relatively high risk that Londoners were exposed to, and they therefore protected those to whom the risk of death was basically most severe. And they did this by increasing the risk of death and injury to civilians who were at a relatively low risk to start with and who remained at a significantly lower risk than those living in the Greater London area even after the introduction of these protective measures. So if we speak somewhat figuratively or trying to speak evocatively, the measures forced British citizens who lived in sparsely inhabited parts of South England to step up and share in the burden that their fellow citizens in London were burdened with. And if we interpret the measures in this way, or we look at them in this way, then they made reasonable demands on the solidarity of the people living in rural southeast England. The measures did not put these people at a very high risk of death and injury in absolute terms, and they burdened the people living in southeast England only with a fraction of the risk that the Londoners were burdened with. It seems to me that a protective measure that makes a reasonable demand on the solidarity of some citizens for the benefit of others who are suffering much more is not a measure that expresses unequal concern. Quite to the contrary, when we are asked to step up in solidarity and share in the burdens of others, we are basically asked to recognize them as our equals. And if this is right, then a protective measure need not express unequal concern merely because it increases the risk to some while decreasing the risk to others. But the logic behind the redirection strategy was very different from the reasonable solidarity logic that I have just discussed. In essence, if you redirect the bombs as a British decision maker, then you single out a specific part of the population and you make that part of the population bear the brunt of the attack. So figuratively speaking, the redirection strategy did not ask the people living in South London for reasonable solidarity. It asked them for a significant sacrifice for everyone else. The redirection strategy therefore expressed an unequal concern, not because it increased the risk to some while decreasing the risk to others, but because it singled out one group of citizens to bear the lion's share of the German attack. And I want to say that this provided one valid moral reason against it. Basically, just dumped the burden of the bombs on those living in South London. But while I believe that the consideration, or that some consideration of equality to some extent speaks against the redirection strategy, there wasn't actually a morally superior alternative available. So consider the confusion strategy. This is what I'm focusing on. If the British had chosen to confuse the enemy, yes, they would have avoided knowingly favouring one part of the population at the expense of another part. But this is just about the only thing that spoke in favour of confusion over redirection. So for one thing, confusing the enemy would not have spread the burden of the bombs more equally. It would merely or simply have reshuffled the burden of the bombs in an entirely unpredictable way. So it would not have made the distribution of the costs more equal, it would merely have changed it in a way that the British were unable to predict. And more importantly, probably compared to redirection, confusing the enemy could have resulted, by official estimates, in thousands of additional fatalities each month. And also importantly, it would have put the excellent reputation of the British double agents at risk. So it simply does not seem to be proportionate to put up with all these disadvantages merely to avoid assigning or consciously assigning the lion's share of the bomb burden to a specific part of the population. It thus seems to me that the British would after all have been justified, morally justified, in adopting the redirection strategy. But they should have remained alert to the fact that the South Londoners had in that way been burdened with more than their fair share. And they should have tried to communicate to the South Londoners that they were taking their suffering extremely seriously. Note that historically, and maybe to some extent still today, South London was home to the working classes. So it was the place where the poorer people lived. And most politicians and their families would have lived north of the river. Moreover, by directing the bombs away from central London, the politicians were essentially keeping Whitehall, which is their place of work, bomb-free. And now, just as it actually happened, as the terror bombing of London dragged on for weeks after weeks and then months after months, people living in South London, in these most affected areas, they became increasingly unnerved. There were letters to newspaper editors, and they started to grow full of complaints. So one of the complaints was that if the weight of the attack had been falling on Whitehall and Buckingham Palace, far more vigorous attempts would have been made to stop it. And if Whitehall were in Kent, South London, these attacks would cease. The people living in South London thus felt that their government wasn't dealing with the bomb threat in an effective way because the bombs happened to be falling in South London. Had the people living in South London known that the government's officials were actually actively keeping the bombs away from themselves, the complaint or the dissatisfaction would probably have been even more pronounced. And it seems clear to me that the South Londoners were in essence complaining that they were not taken seriously or sufficiently seriously. They were confident that more could have been done and that more would have been done if the weight of the attack had fallen somewhere else. Now, as the bombs kept falling, the South Londoners grew convinced that the government wasn't taking decisive action to eliminate the threat, simply because from the government's perspective, the danger actually seemed quite contained. But for the South Londoners, you have to imagine there could hardly have been a more pressing issue than the bomb threat. Every day people were dying, houses were being destroyed, and people were suffering terrible injuries. And the South Londoners had to go about their daily lives just fearing for their lives. And this made the government's perceived inaction insufferably insulting. Now, we have no way, or at least I have no way of knowing, I couldn't establish whether the South Londoners were justified in growing discontented with the government. It is conceivable to me that, short of winning the war, there just was no way of stopping the attacks. I mean, the British kept shooting down the launch sites of the V weapons, but they could really easily be rebuilt. So the Germans kept rebuilding the launch sites of the weapons, and they had built thousands of them, and the British didn't always know where these V weapons were stored. So it's possible that the South Londoners were discontented with their government, but unjustifiably so, because there simply was no way of stopping the attacks. But for our purposes, it suffices that the complaints that the South Londoners brought forward point to one important problem that we have not so far considered directly, and it's a problem for the redirection strategy. So the redirection strategy, adopting the redirection strategy, means adopting a very powerful protective measure compared to all the other protective measures that the British implemented, such as barrage balloons, anti-aircraft guns. It was an extremely effective way of getting the bomb threat under control. To implement the redirection strategy was just to take the edge of the bomb threat for pretty much everyone except the people living southeast of Dulwich. In that way, I think there was a real danger that once the redirection strategy was in place, the bomb threat would just no longer be regarded as an urgent issue in need of further attention. But if this is what happened, then it would have been utterly reprehensible. So if things had in fact turned out this way, then the people living southeast of Dulwich would have had their interests sacrificed for everyone else's benefit in a way that would clearly be irreconcilable with their standing as free and equal members of the British society. So to sum up my philosophical analysis, I have argued that the distinction between doing harm and merely allowing it to occur does not provide us with a morally relevant consideration against the redirection strategy. Considerations of equality, by contrast, do point to an important problem with the redirection strategy that the British government should have done its best to mitigate. Thank you.
Thanks, Suzanne. A fascinating real-life moral dilemma. So as promised, we now have about 30 minutes for questions. I would just say, as sort of general guidance, there's a microphone, first of all, that will be going round. So don't start your question until the microphone has arrived. The function of the microphone is to give us a proper recording at the end. And as far as possible, you know, keep your questions short and concise so that we have time for as many as we can in the half hour. Okay, hands up with any questions. Let's start the second row here on the end, and then the row behind.
Hello. Hi, thank you very much for a very interesting paper. I'm Melis Menant of University of Sussex, and I'm doing a PhD on Habermas's constitutional patriotism. I was thinking that that you're trying to call for a certain notion of moral responsibility, and you're using the language of nation states while you're doing so. You're calling certain states enemies and certain states the governments or the protectors or the civilian lives. But I was thinking that the problem with the doing and directing doctrine that you mentioned in your talk is merely there to protect people who are living within the borders of one nation state, and it doesn't do much to protect different people from different places around the world. So long as security studies and conflict resolution people focus their energies on protecting the civilian deaths within a given nation state and not try to put an end to wars in their own right, I think we're going to keep running into similar problems. And what would you think about human rights and democracy as possible explanations to the problems that you're raising in your paper? This is it.
Mm-hmm. So the question, as I understand it, is the British should not have focused just on their own civilians. They should have focused on maybe all civilians. I think to some extent this is true. So, I mean, there weren't just these letters where the civilians were unhappy that not enough was being done. There were also letters that said we should start to terror bomb Germany again, because that would be a way of effectively making this stop. Now, I don't know if that would have worked, but of course, I mean, the British did say we cannot terror bomb again. It was partly a matter of not having the resources to do so. But I mean, here, of course, you would have a consideration where if you said, suppose terror bombing would work, do we have a reason to protect our own civilians at the expense of civilians' lives in Germany? And then you want to say, very importantly, no, and we should just give up talk about our own civilians versus other civilians, or is that the point you're making?
That is the point I'm making, yeah.
Yeah. So I tried not to enter this, essentially because I very much agree. And I think everything I've said is consistent with the idea that we, or the British, or whoever, that we all have the same duties towards all human beings, at least to the ones who have not forfeited their rights by attacking us culpably or something like that. So I hope that everything that I have said is perfectly consistent maybe with a more cosmopolitan view of justice, or a more cosmopolitan view of thinking about things.
Okay, great. And then directly behind in the third row from the front.
Thank you for your talk. I'd like to ask a question actually on sort of possibly a religious sort of response to some of this. And I'm interested to know why you didn't discuss the doctrine of double effect, but you did discuss the doctrine of doing and allowing. So if you could comment on that and how that might affect your position. And secondly, and possibly contrary to the doctrine of double effect, might be the, in some ways, the Catholic doctrine or the Pauline doctrine, do not do evil even if the heaven should fall. Or the Jewish doctrine, which has a sort of a similar type of view, is that we shouldn't surrender one person to the enemy. It is better that we all die rather than surrender one person to the enemy. So the religious views obviously have quite historical context as well, and I just wondered if you could comment on those, please.
Large question. Maybe I can start with the doctrine of double effect. So the doctrine of double effect, it is actually a Catholic doctrine. I mean, it goes back to Thomas Aquinas. So it says that in its non-absolute form, it says that it's worse to intend harm or to bring about harm in a way that you have to intend the harm than it is to merely foresee that your actions will bring about harm. And the idea here is that if you intend evil, then somehow you're more polluted as a human being, or you become more polluted than if you merely foresee. Your aim is good, but you merely foresee without intending that evil will occur. And actually, there's two philosophers, John Martin Fisher and Mark Ravitza, and they consider the doctrine of double effect, and they try to apply it to the case at hand. So there is a discussion in the philosophical literature that tries to make the doctrine relevant to the case. I just don't think it applies. And in a paper, which if you're interested, I can send you, I do argue that it doesn't apply. I mean, briefly speaking, I just don't see how harm could ever be intended. I mean, if you're redirecting the bombs, what are you doing precisely? You just use selected bomb incidents that have already happened, and you communicate these back essentially with the goal of minimizing losses. I don't see how you ever intend any harm. It has already happened. You select incidents that have already happened, and the goal is always to reduce harm to civilians. And the same with confusion. I mean, the point is you intend to keep your double agents in play. You foresee that whatever you do, there will be harmful consequences, but you do not intend this at all. What were the other two? There was one, the more absolute lesson, don't ever sacrifice anyone.
Don't do evil even if the heaven should fall, or the similar sort of thing. You should not, it's better that we all die than surrender some innocent people to terror.
So that would be like an absolute form of saying something like actively doing something is infinitely worse than merely allowing it to occur. So even if we foresee that, if we refuse to deliver one of our citizens to the terrorists, then we all die, we still shouldn't do it.
Well, almost like a Kantian type. I mean, you might say Atlantean type situation.
We need to try and keep the microphone don't, when.
It is a doing thing.
Here I would just say not plausible. I mean, at some point we have to be pragmatic, and if too many people. So I don't believe in absolutist doctrines, but of course you would have to make the case why that is so.
It might be worth commenting on the general issue that was raised there about whether you think religious principles of any kind have any relevance to this sort of case, or whether you think this should be purely secular ethics.
I think if we can give a philosophical justification as to why they are plausible or important, or why they capture something that is relevant, then I don't see why, merely because we attach the label religious to them, because culturally they happen to be coming from a certain religion, we shouldn't take them seriously. But we still need to test them and discuss why they capture something valuable or important.
Okay, great. The next question was the man in the dark blue jumper at the end of the third row back.
Hi. I can't comment on the philosophy. I'm not competent. So I want to ask questions about the facts you investigated to build up your structure. As I understand it, espionage is a very unreliable and incompetent kind of operation. And how reliable was the information that they got? How much could you rely on it to take a decision? Double agents are the worst kind of misinformation people. And from the things that I have read, there was a lot of confusion. That's the first one. And also, you mentioned the bombs, the V1s and the V2s. V2s were a bit of a different kind of of animal. Mm-hmm. And I think
they were rockets, I think.
Yeah, the analysis could have been different if you'd have concentrated on one or the other.
Yeah, I concentrated on V1s. So the V2s were rockets, and they were actually overshooting London. But then deception was going on for the second generation, or for the
A lot of V2s hit London, and they were a terror weapon. You didn't hear them coming, whereas the V1s.
Yeah, they were silent.
You could hear them,
yeah.
And there was no defence against the V2s.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that the V2s also hit London, because like the V1s, they had a very wide diversion. But on average, they were falling at first many miles north of London, and later they were hitting Essex, like on average, so they were like 8 miles to the northeast of central London on average. And deception seems to have also been going on for this second generation of V-weapons. But it's true that they were more deadly in the sense that they were completely silent, and this was, of course, very scary. With the V1s, you always heard them shut off the motor, and then you know if you have a few seconds and there will be an incident.
Forgive me, I was there.
Yeah.
Okay, let's have the next question from the end of that row there.
Yes, thanks. Two issues for your consideration. Mm-hmm. One argument for the redirection strategy. In favour of the redirection strategy would be that it had the possibility of shortening the war, which in the end would have been the way to minimise overall casualties for everyone, for all soldiers, all civilians, because if the rockets had landed around the Charing Cross area, they would have taken out a number of strategic decision-making centres for the UK, and also a number of vital factories and the docks in the East End, whilst moving the point of impact to the south, would have maintained the capacity of the UK to fight the war and end it more quickly. How does that figure in your argument? My second question to you is that I didn't quite follow why you were in favour of the reasonable solidarity argument in favour of the defensive measures, which saved a lot of people by stopping the V1s from landing in London, but meant that they landed in little villages in Sussex and Surrey. And you said that could be defended on reasonable solidarity. Surely, if we're just looking now at the civilian casualty issue, the movement of the weapons from North London, Central London, to South London is capable of the same justification, because the numbers living in South London were a bit less than the numbers living in Central and North London. Incidentally, I'm arguing a little bit against myself in this, because I actually live in Beckenham, and at the bottom of the road that I now live on, a V1 exploded and made a number of and caused a lot of civilian casualties. Thank you.
Okay, the first question, I thought that's really interesting. I just don't feel competent to assess this. The very few things I know about the end of World War II is that it's mostly the Americans that ensured that it would end. So it would seem to me that it wasn't that crucial to keep the critical infrastructure in Central London, because basically the Americans decided that we should now put a decisive end to the war.
Humour me for a minute and assume that there is something in my argument.
That's very philosophical, by
the way. Yes, yeah. Taking a very philosophical approach to it. Assume there is something in it. Does it make a difference to your argument?
I think it would, and I think that's probably what makes it really interesting for me immediately. Because assuming that it would, and we say that if we redirect the bombs, this ensures that the war will be ended more quickly and in the right way, I mean, the just side wins, then that would seem very much relevant, yes, I would say so. And then the second question was, couldn't the same argument be made? No, I want to say exactly no, it couldn't be made. And I tried to argue in terms of risk that we're exposing different parts of the population to. So the idea of reasonable solidarity is, you have one part of the population that is at the highest risk already. And then reasonable solidarity means people who are at a very low risk have to bear a slightly higher risk from now on in order to bring down the risk to those who are at highest risk. That's the idea of reasonable solidarity. We share the burden more equally. And by deciding that one part of the population has to bear the lion's share of the burden, so it could be South London or it could be Dulwich, or we decide to redirect further, then it becomes, what was it? Mary from Beckenham. I've never been to Beckenham, so I always lose. So, or we make it Beckenham, but then it's always a decision who should bear the brunt of the attack, and then the idea is that's not reasonable solidarity for the people living in Beckenham, it's just they have to pay the main price. So I want to say that there's a difference here, that there's it's not the same thing.
Okay, the next question from the row behind, end of the row behind.
Hi. So I like the example with the terrorist threat, because it seems like there are at least three things going on here that make that example seem unpalatable. So the one is that we pick in 20 specific people, mm-hmm. right? So you're kind of unfairly singling people out. The second one is then there's the degree of harm, and you might think the degree of harm goes in favor of singling out people. And the other one is the sort of like ineluctability, like once you've selected those people, then you have to march them over to the executioners, right? And that's obviously you're kind of implicating the action, right? Let's maybe take that last factor out, because that's the doing and allowing thing, basically, which you said goes kind of the same way for the bombing case. Either way, you're doing something, as it were. I guess what it really comes down to is the kind of question of randomness when you single out. Right. So if you said, okay, we either get 40 deaths by terrorist attacks, or we get 20 deaths that we march off to the executioner, mm-hmm. but say it's done by lottery, mm-hmm. right? So everyone in the population has an equal chance of being one of the 20, and then we say, maybe that's an okay deal, because it would have been randomly 40 people in the population would have been killed by terrorists, all 20 people randomly by lottery, right? And then I guess the question is, like, then there's this kind of trade-off between kind of how much you're singling people out versus how random it is, right? So, in Southeast London, okay, you can single out to a certain extent because of the geographical area you're in, but it's still somewhat random, as in you're not actually literally plucking people off the streets in Southeast London saying, it's you now, mm-hmm. right? So maybe I'm just asking you, I guess, to comment on, like, how much, like, what's the relevant trade-off between this kind of, how random does it need to be before it counts as... I mean, it possibly goes somewhat to the previous question that was asked, like, what's a reasonable solidarity? Like, how high a chance do you need to have your number of coming up for it to count as, like, an unreasonable burden, right? Like, if they're able to redirect the bombs anywhere in the whole of England, mm-hmm. right, then everyone's chance of number coming up is really low.
Yeah, then don't right? bring it down a lot. Yeah, so I definitely don't have an answer like, that's the number. But one thing that struck me is when you started this, it's 20 specific individuals and we need to march them off. But that doesn't actually harm my example, because the example is to show that it's not all there is to showing an equal and balanced concern for the safety of everyone to just minimize losses to civilian lives. And you could say, even if it's 20 specific individuals that the terrorists are looking for, and even if we need to march them, then a utilitarian, as I have called them, would still have to say that is what it means to show equal concern, because that is what it means to minimize losses in this specific case. But that wasn't really your question, just to say. I mean, once we realize that there are all these different considerations that seem relevant to what it means to show equal concern, for example, if a terrorist asks for a specific individual, then as soon as we deliver that individual, there's just a way in which it does not show equal concern for everyone, specifically that individual. The second one, so when is it still reasonable solidarity? When is it sacrifice? I mean, in a way, the way I have not defined, but implicitly defined the terms, it's a sacrifice as soon as your risk becomes higher than average, because then you are asked for more than your, what we could call, fair share. And as long as your risk is below average and we don't raise you above average, it would still be maybe solidarity, because you're still lower than average. I don't know if that answers the question.
Okay, let's have the next question from the row behind, the man in the purple jumper.
Thank you. This is fascinating. I was wondering if in the paper you discuss a bit more about the actual way the decision was made in the committee, in the war cabinet, because you kind of assume in the discussion that what ought to be done, if it was a single individual making the decision, would be the same thing as a committee of people discussing and taking a decision, and especially in this case where, as you said, Churchill was absent, and so you can think that maybe the kind of moral leader was not there, and so maybe they would have fallen into a more kind of conservative view, and how did this would play in...
Yeah, no, I don't discuss this anymore because I don't know. Actually, I do a little bit more. So there's one spy, but someone just said spies are not reliable at all. He has written a book. It's called The Counterfeit Spy. Sefton Delmer is the author. So he says he worked for the deception authorities, the British deception authorities in World War II. He says that what trickled down after the war cabinet meeting is that there was actually one individual who really resisted redirection, and that was Herbert Morrison. He was the Home Secretary. And according to this spy, who may not be very reliable, Morrison said, "Who are we to act as God? We have no right to act as God." And then the other ministers were convinced. So there seems to have been a leader, I mean, if this is true. And I do quote that in my paper, "Who are we to act as God?" And then I say, if you show a balanced and equal concern for everyone, then that's a way of refusing to act as God, because you don't select any part of the population to bear the lion's share of the attack. But that's not all there's to your question, or does that answer the question?
Okay, and the next question from the row behind, over towards the left. Microphone is on its long way around. Please do wait for the microphone before starting the question.
Thank you very much for a very interesting topic there. I'm wondering, how do you measure equal concern? Are everybody equal? One. So, and secondly, isn't it better to be in control of where the bombs land, mm-hmm. and therefore to be able to direct where the bomb lands?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the first question, how do you measure equality?
The person that I have referred to as utilitarian just has a very precise answer. They will tell you equality means that every civilian's life is assigned the same positive value in a calculation about the right thing to do. That's all there is to equality. And I, as a less consequentialist moral philosopher, I have more problems articulating my views clearly. but I would say, yes, this is one important aspect, but I have tried to show it's not all there is to treating people or treating citizens equally. So when we have a choice of assigning ex ante risks, if we have a risk distribution that is more equal, then that's another way of treating people equally, and it's relevant to some extent. So it's difficult to say precisely what it means for a government to treat its people equally, but I think if it just sends one to be delivered to terrorists, we can make the case that even if it minimizes losses to its own civilians, that in some sense it has not treated everyone equally. And the second question, isn't being in control very important? I think so, and that's why I think that even if I have identified one reason against redirection, it's not a very decisive, or it's not at all a decisive reason, given the circumstances of the case. It was very important to be in control of where the MPI, the mean point of impact of the bombs, would move to. And like I said, confusion would not even have spread the risk of the bombs. It would have just been a way of washing one's hands and saying, we did not knowingly choose one part of the population to be affected the worst, and that doesn't seem very valuable in itself. So I agree that being in control under the circumstances of the case was a very important consideration.
Okay, can I just get a show of hands of who has a question that they've not yet been able to ask? Okay, so let's have one from the end of this, three rows from the back, and then we'll go over to the other side after that.
You mentioned a third solution would have been to tell the double agents to stop communications and to stop feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And then the German would have turned to their loyal agents, to who were not very many.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, how was the German, the British government, really aware that there were very few loyal spies remaining, and that they had managed to turn most of the agents? Because I mean, the point of spy is to be secret. So how could they have known that there were only very few loyal spies remaining? And did they know?
They didn't know, and I think, yeah, they couldn't have known. But I don't think I have implied that they knew that there were only very few left. Okay, so I think your question gets at something really important, and it actually relates nicely to the last question. What does it mean to treat people equally? I think an important aspect is that for a government to treat its citizens equally, it depends on what the government knows. If the government had full information, then it would have meant something else to treat people equally, because then confusion would not even have been a possibility, because you just know maybe if there are no spies left, or if you know what the non-turned spies are reporting, then you know what will be happening anyway. So treating people equally is about an attitude you take up towards them, and that depends on the information you have. So confusion was only a way of avoiding showing an unequal concern, because there were certain things that the British government did not know. But yes, of course, you can never know how many non-turned spies there are. I mean, it seems that after the war, we have now a good idea that not many non-turned spies were left. Again, this Sefton Delmer spy argues that all the German spies have been turned, but it seems to me that this is just the kind of information that almost by definition cannot be reliable. So it's just not the kind of information that would be available.
Okay, the next question from five rows back here, the man in the glasses.
Thank you. Very interesting. So I think I agree with you that it seems that this unequal consideration is at least one of the reasons why redirection would be worse than confusion. But it seems to me that there could be other reasons as well. So think of an alternative case where It's not that they just go for a redirection to the south of London, but instead select the neighborhood randomly. And then you could ask, so is this redirection prime, is this in some way worse than confusion? And I think it seems to me that it is. So the neighborhood that is targeted by this policy would have reasons to complain about this. So stop it there.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think it's an interesting thought. What it seems to show to me is that if you will have to keep the same risk distribution and it's going to be an unequal risk distribution, then just somehow randomly assigning like who will have to bear the peak, that just that doesn't seem to be a way of showing equal concern. It's more of if you have a chance to change the distribution to maybe share the burden more equally, then you have a reason to do so. And so if redirection actually means fixing a highly unequal distribution, but your alternatives are not very good, you actually lack an alternative where you have the possibility to make or to spread the risk more equally, then it's just kind of misguided to want to, by randomly assigning the distribution, somehow treat people more equally. That doesn't seem to get to the point of what's at stake. So that's a very nice point.
Okay, there was a question from the second row over this side.
You referred to Morrison in the War Cabinet arguing we're not God. Mm-hmm. But what I understood is that he almost did want to be God because his reason wasn't to get equality for everybody but protection for his constituents because he represented a South London constituency.
Yeah. But he managed to convince everyone else. I mean, that's amazing. very true. I think that's an important consideration, and I thought about it as well, but then it seemed to me maybe he was extremely like talented as a speaker or something, but he managed to convince the rest of the cabinet that there was something to the idea of that it would be playing God to redirect the bombs. So, it's too bad we don't have the minutes. It would be so nice to have the minutes of this meeting. Maybe it would help us assess whether Morrison maybe wanted to play God. I don't know, is he known to be a very nice person, or do you know anything more about that? No?
He was not a nice person.
Right.
It was what somebody once said of him, that Morrison is his own worst enemy, and a cabinet colleague of his, Ernest Bedley, hated Morrison, said, "Not while I'm still alive." That's a true story.
Oh, I should write that down. Okay, so Morrison is his own worst enemy. Then Bevin said, not while I'm still alive. I have to remember that. Yeah, okay. That lends support to your idea, I guess.
Great. Is there anyone who still has a question and hasn't been able to ask it? Because if not, then we can leave it at that. And thanks, Susan, very much for an extremely interesting talk.